You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, we're going to do something a little bit different. So, Danny LaRue is here. Say hi, Danny.
Hey there.
So, I just woke up in Australia. It is Thursday, my time. It's Wednesday, 2:35, it looks like, Pacific time.
Yeah.
In the United States. And I got a message from Danny at... probably, I don't know, in the middle of the night, sometime my time. And I happened to wake up at like 5:30 a.m. or whatever and looked at it. And he said, if you see this, it would be funny to do a podcast where you react to everything that happened overnight or something like that. So I was like, okay, like, that sounds fun. Like, let's do this. So I happened to look in my work Slack channel, and these are the only messages I've seen so far. These are the only things that I know has happened today, Wednesday in the United States, June 16th. I know that LeBron tweeted about injuries. I know that there's apparently a John Calipari coaching rumor.
That I hadn't even heard about that before you mentioned it. But okay. Yes, that is there is apparently something related to that.
And then finally, my editor, the great Sergio Gonzalez, who is one of the best people on planet Earth that I know, put into my Slack channel. So when I file a story, I have like a Slack channel that I input all of my stories to. And he put the GIF of Troy, so Donald Glover from Community, walking into the apartment and the whole thing just being on fire and craziness happening. Saying, like, that's what it's going to be like when I wake up. So that's the only things that I know so far. I have no idea.
And I want to give a shout out to our colleague John Hollinger for tweeting at some point, which thankfully you haven't seen, basically like, oh God, Sam Vecini's going to wake up to something. And that triggered for me. I'm like, wait, this is a podcast. And so I texted you and I G-chatted you and said, if we can pull this off, this might be really interesting. So are you physically and emotionally prepared for this?
Yeah, and I will tell you too, before I went to bed last night, I saw the Chris Paul news too.
Okay. So you know the first thing.
Yeah.
And so, because that happened at, okay, so yeah, so you, I was wondering where that was going to be in it, because that was really early Pacific time. So yeah, the first thing that happened,
well,
from my perspective, the
funny thing is on the Chris Paul thing, I got a text from someone who is connected within like the betting industry, let's say. Have you heard anything about Chris Paul? So mm-hmm. I got that yesterday while I was still awake.
So that's all you know about Chris Paul?
No. I know that he's in the COVID protocols.
Yes. Okay. So 5:38 a.m. Pacific time, when I happen to be awake, get the reporting from Shams Charania that Chris Paul has entered the COVID protocols, and a little bit of further color from John Campadoro and others that basically Chris Paul did test positive, so it is related to a positive COVID test. And somebody also told John that he's going to have to pass at least two tests to return. There will not be a further update on CP until Saturday at the earliest. However, Saturday is still before the Western Conference Finals will start. They could start on Sunday at the absolute earliest, or they could start on Tuesday if they will start Tuesday if Jazz Clippers goes to a seventh game.
Yeah, so this one was one that, like, you know, I had a couple people on my texts like melting down about, and I wasn't that worried because of that. I awarded it one single yike in a text message, I think was the way that I phrased it. I'm just like kind of in a, okay, let's see what happens with Chris Paul kind of deal. Look, I don't want to dive into the world of, like, is he vaccinated? Is he not vaccinated? Like, please, everyone go get vaccinated. That's the right move here. But it would be weird to me, I guess, if the president of the Players Association didn't get vaccinated for some reason. Like, that was also a reaction.
People believe that he was. It would be, I talked with Ben Taylor. I actually did a, we did Real Jam Radio earlier into the day, Pacific time. And so, because he used to do a daily COVID podcast, and so this would be the second one that we've known of a what's like kind of referred to as a breakthrough positive, meaning that a player tested positive having been vaccinated, the other being Damian Lee.
Yep.
And he said the big factor, and this is not surprising based on everything we know from other things, is that the big factor is going to be whether Chris Paul is symptomatic. Because if he's symptomatic, then this timeline starts to get serious. And, like, you know, even with him being vaccinated, then we start to get into some questions. But if he's asymptomatic, maybe we can be a little bit more optimistic about this. And so we're just going to have to see.
Okay.
The wildness.
That one feels like kind of a, okay, let's hope for the best here. I don't think it's going to affect too much. Maybe he sits out a game. Like, let's see what happens, right?
Okay, so then 30 minutes later, 6:08 in the morning,
okay,
Brian Windhorst is the original one to report this. Kawhi Leonard is expected to miss game 5 against the Jazz with a knee injury. His status for the rest of the series is in doubt as well. There has been much subsequent reporting. Kawhi, the fear per Shams is that this is an ACL injury, but it could be an ACL sprain. But basically, the assumption is that Kawhi is out at least for the rest of this series, if not the rest of the playoffs. / who the hell knows? Maybe next season. Like, we still don't know the extent of the injury. There is no formal diagnosis or timeline yet. But Kawhi Leonard is dealing with something. He told the team last night, so meaning Tuesday night U.S. time, that to expect him to be out. And remember, he got pulled 4 minutes roughly from the end of game 4. And I noticed he looked a little bit different. Kawhi is notoriously hard to read, but it did seem like there was something off. And that's an earthquake.
That literally kind of changes the title picture a little bit.
More than a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you thought of this Jazz-Clippers series over the course of the last 3 games of it. I mean, it's funny because I felt like the Clippers and Suns were a very interesting matchup for a number of reasons. I kind of think the Suns have a really good matchup on Utah because if there's one thing that the Suns do, it's just absolutely destroy drop coverage because of the way that Chris Paul and Devin Booker can kind of attack seams and everything. But then again, if we don't know if Chris Paul's going to play, the Western Conference has just been totally blown to smithereens now, and things have really opened up for Utah, I guess. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's the way that I was thinking about it. I got a tweet about this to this effect. I wish I could give credit, but I don't remember who. Today was a little bit of a bore.
Yeah,
that somebody saying like how Utah's odds of winning the Western Conference shifted so dramatically in a day that they never even played, at least not as of when we're recording this podcast. And so, I mean, because Kawhi Leonard being out, that makes the Clippers significantly more beatable, and then Chris Paul, we don't know exactly what the timeline's going to be, but he is less available than we anticipated. I think that is a fair assumption to make. And so, yeah, I mean, and it's also just massively disappointing when you think about Kawhi has been wonderful overall in these playoffs, that he gets this, you know, the Clippers weren't totally healthy because Serge Ibaka is out for the year after having back surgery, but now another one of the top 5, top 10, top 3 players in the NBA is out for an indeterminate period of time. And the other thing that, like, I hadn't even thought about an ACL, to be honest, before Shams tweeted it. And that is, you know, like, so then we start talking about next year, and Kawhi is a pending unrestricted free agent. I still think he opts out, even if it's an ACL tear.
I can't imagine that he won't, and I can't imagine that the Clippers will be like, no, let's not re-sign Kawhi.
Exactly. So we'll see. It sucks. And so, yeah, that's, so those two happening within a half an hour of each other, that was like, okay, things are, and those are, I would say, in terms of the game on the court, those to me are the two biggest things that happen. There are a lot of other fun things we will discuss, but those are the two where it's like, okay, like, this is, these are things.
Well, I'm going to be honest, I can't imagine anything bigger than those two things.
There is not.
Yeah, and this is what I would imagine. Like, I got sent the LeBron tweets about, like, injuries and everything, and this is what I would imagine he was tweeting about, right? The both of these, or at least the Kawhi factor, you know, the Chris Paul.
Yeah, because I mean, Chris Paul getting COVID. I mean, that's kind of a different thing.
But allegedly. it's still really. I think it was an astute point by LeBron, first and foremost, to be as frustrated about the condensed schedule as he was. I personally, well, it's hard because, like, I think that we probably should have just played fewer games this year. Like, we probably just should have played 62 games instead of 72 games, right? I understand that that would have affected the television contracts. But, like, to an extent, right? Like, not like, to a drastic measure, but the effect that this season has potential to have long-term over the NBA in terms of, like, the Nuggets with Jamal Murray, right? The Nuggets, I think, would have been in a very good position to go on an NBA championship run if Jamal Murray was healthy this year. Now he has a torn ACL. Doesn't seem like he's going to get back until, what, like March next year, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be before February. And that's right. The other potentially important thing with Kawhi, here's hoping it's not important, is that this season is shifted relative to next season. So heaven forbid Kawhi has a torn ACL or even a partial tear, then right now, we're even with the end of the NBA Finals next year. We're not even with the regular middle of the regular season or anything else. Like,
no.
If it's a 10-month recovery, Kawhi's out for the entire regular season. So we don't know. Hopefully it's
part
smaller
of the playoffs, like for right. sure.
Yeah, and so Jeff Stotts noted that Jay Crowder sprained his ACL and avoided surgery in the 2015 playoffs. But the problem was, in terms of projecting things out for Kawhi, should that be the diagnosis, is that the Celtics were eliminated before Crowder could have returned. So we don't really know, like, if there's a possibility that's like a 5-game injury or something like that. I personally don't think, let's say it is a 5-game injury, I don't think the Clippers make it to a 5th game. So it's sort of, it matters, but it's sort of, you know, it's kind of a different thing.
Well, mathematically, I don't think they make it to a 5th game either against the Jazz. Like, I mean, it's basically Paul George on his own.
Yeah, like they don't have a clear cut. And now we're getting to the point where the Clippers are so shorthanded on, like, wings, on perimeter players that they're going to have to start playing, you know, figuring out some stuff.
Oh, like it's going to be like Luke Kennard for 30 minutes a night, right? Like,
it kind of has to be.
Like,
or maybe more Zubats. Maybe you go in kind of that direction. But I mean, that didn't work out particularly well.
Can't do it, because the other thing that, you know, similarly to Phoenix with what I talked about, like, Utah just has so many different ways to kill drop coverage with the two pull-up shooting guards. There's just no way you can do that. I think that you have to go small. I think you have to go probably Kennard 30 minutes a night and have him guard guys like Ingles and... I don't even know if I feel great about him on Boyan, but, you know, you're going to have to maybe make some deals with the devil here, quote unquote. That's bad. I mean, yeah, this dramatically shifts Utah's title. Like, I'm like reacting to this on the fly now. Like, I'm like trying to navigate all of the thoughts here. I mean, like, hey, like,
to
this
me,
sucks
you,
for
Utah. Utah has to be a heavy favorite in this series.
And yeah, no, for one. Sure. Like, I would be interested to know how their title odds have fallen in terms of betting. I'm afraid to look because I'm afraid to see what else has happened while we're podcasting. But it can't, like... Okay, so Kawhi is now out probably for these next few games. And Kawhi is also potentially out for next series. And so it's like literally we have no idea at this point.
Yeah, there is no definitive timeline, but... I think the odds that he, like, skated by seem extremely low. Like, the odds that it's something where it's short, but we don't know for sure. So, you know, I'm more than a little concerned, but we do not know definitively.
Okay. Well,
are you kind of feel like that pod is settled?
No, but like, yes. Like, I just don't know what else. Given that it's such an uncertain timeline, like, it's probably just worth talking about the Utah series, like, real quick. Like,
sure.
Utah is very clearly the favorite now. Utah is, in all likelihood, going to go on to play Phoenix at this point if Kawhi misses these final three games of this series, potentially three games. I guess wouldn't stun me if we saw, like, a Clippers, let's rally around Kawhi moment tonight and, like, play super hard and aggressive, because the one thing that those Clippers guys do have is a lot of, like, energy for the most part. Like, guys like Patrick Beverley, Marcus Morris, like, Paul George to an extent. Like, I can see them finding a way to, like, especially with Ty Lue, like, maybe, like, grimy some things up and, like, try and, you know, slow down the game as much as they can, maybe. Like, I mean, what do we think their best strategy is? Like, they have to slow down the game and they just have to get, like, aberrant three-point shooting, which means they have to create open three-point shots, which, like...
And the Clippers probably... They probably need to try to get stuff in transition, but they don't have the guys to do that.
I think you can't try and do that. You can't try and run with Utah. I think you have to play very slow, limit possessions as much as possible. Like, make it like a 90s game, basically, with guys like Pat Bev, Marcus Morris, you know, like I said, like, I think Paul George would be fine in that era. You know, maybe you do play, it's hard. That's what makes Utah so hard, because, like, the way you would do that is you play bigger, you'd play Zubats, you'd, like, just try and, like, you know, play big across the board. But, like, do you play a little bit of, like, playing zone against Utah feels like a disaster idea, too, because of how much they can shoot you out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe try some different concepts of a zone, like, yeah, maybe even a 3-2, like, and they'll hit some from the corners, but you could do something like, I don't think it, I'm skeptical about a 2-3 just because that above the break three is so dangerous for Utah, but yeah. it's, I mean, and the switching systems will work. I mean, they have some guys that can do it, but when you don't have Kawhi, think about the effort that Utah put in to not attack Kawhi Leonard in game four in particular. And so now Donovan Mitchell has a much easier runway than he did before. And
well, the yeah. problem is, like, the lack of two-way players, right? Like,
right.
It's, okay, we have to play Kennard or Terrence Mann, right? Like, or we have to put both of them on the court, and then we have 4-on-5 on one end of the floor, no matter if we're on offense or defense, right? So, yeah, this just became... I mean, like, look, we might see the Clippers come out tonight and, like, really work their ass off and, like, fight for this, and maybe they can grimy it up and slow it down and get a win with some, like, aberrant three-point shooting. But, I mean, this became a very, very, very difficult task for them.
It did.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Let's see. What else do we got here, Danny?
So... less than 2 hours later, 7:55 a.m. Pacific time, Woj and Andrew Lopez report that Stan Van Gundy is out as New Orleans Pelicans coach.
Oh, one and done. How about that?
The second one and done coach of this season.
Yeah, that's bad. So, like, I know that New Orleans fans were excited about the defense that New Orleans played in the second half of the year. I know that the numbers said they were not that bad of a defense in the second half of the year and that they got better. I mean, you hire Stan Van Gundy to instill a defensive mindset and to, like, make the defensive mindset work. And I just did not really see that with them. I saw them taking advantage of bad offensive teams for the most part in the second half of the year and kind of getting some poor shooting performances from those teams. I guess that I think they finished like seventh or so in the second half of the year defensively in terms of rating, but so much of it didn't seem to be culture. It seemed to be like Steven Adams, like, holding up the scheme like he was fucking Atlas or something like that. Yeah, that does not surprise me that they would decide to move in a different direction. And I think more coaches and ownership staffs, or more front offices and ownership staffs, should be willing to do this when it's not working, because it just didn't seem like the Steven or Stan Van Gundy thing was working.
We also got a little bit of subsequent reporting. I'm sure there is going to be more to come from Christian Clark of the Times-Picayune that there was conflict and a quote unquote strained relationship between Van Gundy and Brandon Ingram. So that is interesting as well. Okay. Well, we'll see. And I mean, I'm guessing there will be more to come. That was a, you know, kind of a different circumstance. And so the other interesting parallel, I brought up, this is the second one and done coach of this NBA season, is that in both circumstances here and in Indianapolis, it appears that the coach who hired and fired the first coach will be the one who hires the second coach. And so in both this and the Nate Bjorkgren situation, will David Griffin and Kevin Pritchard go back to the people that they considered last year and maybe give those a second run and say, oh, we misread this person and they did it? Do they look at new candidates? I mean, this New Orleans job, it's a really intriguing challenge because you have Zion Williamson, who's a blossoming superstar, but the Pelicans roster is pretty locked in, and it could be a whole hell of a lot more locked in very soon, you know, depending on what happens with Lonzo Ball and Josh Hart and some other pieces. But there also isn't necessarily the immediate win now pressure compared to a place like Boston. So I don't, and arguably Portland as well. So I think of New Orleans as a pretty strong job, like of compared to the ones that are out there. But it depends on kind of what you want and what kind of coach you are.
So, like, this is a fascinating question, right? If you're New Orleans at this point, is the move to just, like, tear it down, like, right now, and say, we have the guy, we know we have the guy in Zion Williamson, who is going to be a top five player in the league. We have some really interesting young players on rookie-scale deals, like Nickeil Alexander-Walker is cheap for 2 more years, Kyra Lewis is cheap for 3 more years. Jackson Hayes is fine, but like Jackson Hayes is cheap for 2 more years. If we can wave and stretch Eric Bledsoe, we move Brandon Ingram for whatever we can get Brandon Ingram for, and we let Lonzo walk, we have a pretty clear cap sheet at that point and a pretty clear runway to be able to do things, and then move Steven Adams as well, because I don't think 17 for Steven Adams is all that onerous in terms of moving him, to be honest.
Like it's a negative value contract, but it's not heinous, you know, like it's not in the same ballpark as some of the other, you know, like, oh god, we have to get off of this type of things. So I do think it's negative value, and Adams is getting older, but he has been generally pretty durable, super durable before the last couple of years. But I agree with you. I think that using Zion Williamson,
these picks coming up too, right?
Right. Like, I mean, those picks aren't necessarily premium assets. Like that's the difference between right. New Orleans and let's say some of the stuff that other teams might be getting, maybe the Nets picks eventually, also some of the Houston picks that went to OKC, depending on the protection and everything fun there. But I think Zion is the lens. If the goal is to be a team that can make the conference finals or win the championship, then I think you seriously consider tearing down. And I think of Ingram and Zion as a poor fit in some ways, more conceptually than like actually. I mean, personality and all that. Like Brandon Ingram has the skill set to fix next design, but I don't think he particularly wants to do that. And that matters, you know, where the rubber meets the road and everything else there. And Ingram, it's also the circumstance where I think you want to move early rather than late if you don't think he is the right player. Now, if you think there's a chance, like, because other teams are interested, Ingram is not a bad guy. He's just possibly a poor fit. And so in that sort of a circumstance, this was the same argument that Nate and I used about trading Caris LeVert. Now that ended up netting, you know, on because he just didn't really have a place on the Nets. Dinwiddie got hurt almost instantly, and then LeVert ended up going, you know, getting involved in the Harden trade. So it ended up a little bit different than that. But I could see moving early rather than moving late being good with him. I don't know. I'm still not at the point yet where I have a determination on Kyra Lewis and Nickeil in terms of are they starters on a really good team or are they more backups? But the other reason why you consider it is New Orleans is in this weird place where Zion is good enough and they have enough surrounding talent that if they don't go aggressively soon, the amount of premium resources they have to really get the other stuff coming is going to be very limited. You know, just right. As a practical consideration, like it's hard to add high-level talent after, you know, once you're at that point, because you're not getting high-end draft picks unless they pull one from somewhere else. And I'm skeptical that the Lakers picks will be that kind of a return. And, like, they have Milwaukee's 2024. First of all, that's a couple years out. Second of all, like, Milwaukee's probably still going to be pretty good then.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole bet was on, okay, does Giannis re-sign? And then even if he does, like, those other picks are later even than that, right? Like, they have, like, a 2026, right?
Yeah, they have stuff like that.
Yeah. Look, I don't think New Orleans is going to, like, tear this down.
I agree.
Like, I don't think that's going to be their plan. But I would strongly consider it if I was them. In the case of Ingram, I really like Brandon. I've been very, very high on Brandon throughout the course of his career. I think he's an excellent basketball player. I think he needs to work on the defensive side of the floor. I think that you and I, particularly, and other evaluators thought Zion would be a lot further ahead defensively than where he is. And I still think Zion has a chance to be very good defensively because he's so athletic. I think that, you know, the way he got thrown in last season, middle of the year, wasn't totally in shape. I think that exacerbated the way that things looked defensively. And then this year, it's a totally new scheme, totally new ideas in terms of the way that they were playing. And then on top of that, midway through the year, they started to play a different scheme defensively and went more toward like a drop coverage scheme defensively. So he's played like three different defensive schemes in 2 years now. I think that he's probably going to be okay defensively at some point in his career. He's just not there yet. But if you think that there's a chance he's only an average defender and you think that Brandon is not going to be a good defender, I wonder if you try to make a move where you move Brandon Ingram for something like Miles Turner plus. Like, I wonder if you could get like Ingram for Turner and I don't know. What is, give me a name that you think would make sense, right? Like that seems like the move, because then you have the stretch five who's an elite level defender. The Sabonis Turner fit doesn't really make a ton of sense to me long term. But Miles is, I think, only under contract for one more year. Even if Miles, so say that Miles stays, you have your center of the future. Say that he leaves, you're kind of
so emptied so out just so we have fine. It. Turner, like, he's they're paying him through 22-23.
Okay, so he has two more seasons. Okay, yeah. So but that's still like an easily movable deal if it doesn't work. I'm just like kind of spitballing and trying to come up with ideas. Again, I don't think they're going to do this, but I agree with you. I think you want to move earlier rather than later, even though I really like Brandon as a player. I wouldn't want to make the same mistake that New Orleans made with Anthony Davis, where they put all of their eggs into the basket early with Anthony. They went out and they signed Solomon Hill and, you know,
Osher.
Yeah, that's right. Did they sign Ajinsa as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, like they went out, they spent a shit ton of money, basically. And each one more, if I remember correctly as well, was like another guy that they brought in. And they brought in these like very average players. I guess that like the thing with Brandon is not an average player. He's an all-star. But if the fit doesn't work, I think you don't want to be tied to this situation long term, maybe.
Well, and what's interesting is the Pelicans, they're limited in flexibility as of right now, but they could change that pretty dramatically pretty quickly if they wanted to. You know, Zion's making 10.7 next year, 13.5 after that, and then he's extension eligible, and we'll see where things are at that point. You know, if Bledsoe, you could either grin and bear it, and then just he only has a light partial guarantee for the last year, could even just eat that money. You could structure this a couple different ways. Could do that. Adams, maybe you find a taker. Maybe it's one of those circumstances where you trade him for a worse player with less money, or maybe somebody just wants to take him on. The center crop is notoriously weak, and so getting a guy on a two-year contract, maybe you have to take on somebody modest, you know, all that kind of stuff, and then. So, but then Lonzo and Josh Hart, they significantly crimp that flexibility should David Griffin decide to bring them back. And so that was always
what... Let's actually do some cap math here. So let's say that they eat the Eric Bledsoe money and just pay him $18 million and cut him, right? And then they move Steven Adams into cap space with someone. I think that they probably would be able to do that, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they would like need to give up an additional asset to move Steven Adams into cap space. So they get someone super cheap on an expiring deal or something. So you have Zion and Brandon Ingram, that's like 44, 45 million.
Are we talking for 21, 22, or are we talking for...
I'm talking for the summer of 2022, this would be.
Okay.
And so going into the 22-23 season. So you'd have 45 million on the books or so with Brandon Ingram and Zion. Add it and say 55 with Jackson Hayes and Kyra Lewis, and then 60 with Nikhil Alexander-Walker. You can pay Lonzo probably 20 million or so. And given the way that the cap is supposed to move up, you know, plus your
they
first
could have a max
this
spot.
Year, they could be pretty close to a max spot. And that's with Jackson Hayes, who, you know, probably not going to be worth $6.8 million in that last year. Like, you'd probably be able to move him pretty easily. So maybe you do. Maybe you do just, you know, keep Brandon Ingram. You keep Lonzo. You keep Zion. You keep Hayes, Kyra, and Nikhil. And then you try to induce someone with a max spot. You understand that you're going to be bad this year, or maybe you keep Steven Adams and develop these guys and try to develop a defensive mindset and move Steven Adams next summer. For the love of God, get Eric Bledsoe off this roster sooner rather than later. It was just not fun to watch that this year. But and then you'd have the 3.9 from Bledsoe's money too, I realized too.
But maybe you could even find a taker for that. Maybe you trade Bledsoe for somebody who's making more but on a shorter contract or something else. Like, there are a couple different...
They could
stretch that 3.9. Like, you could... So then it's basically, you know, it's a little over a mil.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that they probably would do that if they go down that road.
If they want to, sure.
But they can stay flexible enough that I think that as long as Lonzo doesn't get over, like, $22 million a year, 20 to 22, I think that you probably do keep this group together, because I don't think Brandon Ingram's going to lose his value over the next year. Like, it might be in 2 years, like the summer of 2023, he might be a problem for you. But I think you probably keep this together one more year, basically, and let it ride, because there's still enough flexibility beyond that.
It's a totally reasonable approach. I mean, to me, it is a common refrain that doesn't necessarily make for good radio, but you listen, and if somebody surprises you, then you strike, and if no one surprises you, then you keep it together, at least in terms of the Ingram part of it.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back so Danny can continue to, like, blow my mind with things. Okay, we're back. So Stan Van Gundy out, Kawhi hurt, and obviously the Chris Paul thing that I knew about already. Okay.
Now, a half an hour after that, so 8:25 a.m. Pacific time, Scottie Brooks is no longer the coach of the Washington Wizards.
Okay. Well, he was expiring, right?
Yeah. So they couldn't, the way Woj phrased it is they couldn't come to an agreement on a new deal. And so thus, he will not be the coach.
Okay. I kind of thought that end of the year run might have saved him. I would imagine that, like, maybe the Wizards offered him, if the way that Woj phrased it was that, maybe they offered him, like, another year, and he was like, no, I don't want to be a lame duck again. Like, is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, but what's interesting to me about it, and granted, everybody's working with incomplete information, whether we're talking media members or the principals, I'm skeptical that Scott Brooks is going to get another job this offseason. And so it certainly appears that the Wizards didn't want to pay Brooks what he was making before. Remember, he got a huge... I think he was making like $7 million a year before this. And Scott Brooks isn't that level of coach. And so one theory of it is that they offered him less money per year for what... I don't know the term, whether it's 1 year like your idea or three or whatever. And he's just like, no, I don't want to do that. But if it was that approach, to me, it's like having a head job with capable players. And, you know, he seems like he has a pretty firm supporter in one Russell Westbrook. Like, that's not the worst thing in the world, situationally. And while there are jobs that are open, I don't know that there's one that seems like a clear constituency for Scott Brooks, especially when you consider his tenure with the Wizards. And it's not like Washington has really had a calling card. Like, this has been a criticism of mine for Brooks for a couple of years, is that you can't point to anything and say, well, let's say Steve Clifford. Like, when you hire Steve Clifford, these things are going to happen, and you can have these expectations. You know, Clifford is a great floor raiser. He's done a lot with limited defensive personnel. But, like, oh, Scottie Brooks is going to maximize this talent offensively, or even at this point, you know, his defensive reputation has been hurt a lot because the Wizards were truly awful. Not this year, but the 2 years immediately before that. Now, they had terrible personnel, but that's there. And also the question of how desirable is this Wizards job? What do they want to do? The only reporting that I've seen, I mean, of course, there's the normal bandied about, but the one that had a little bit of sizzle for me is Wes Unseld Jr., when you think about his father's connection to the franchise, but also there have been a lot of connections between the Wizards and the Nuggets in the past too, including trades and everything else.
And Tim Connolly being from the area. Yeah, I would think that there are so many connections there. Tim Connolly from the area, I believe. I don't want to.
Well, yeah, didn't they recruit him for that job originally?
They did, and I think that there is like a relationship there. So I would imagine that Connolly would go to bat for Unseld. Unseld would obviously have the familial connection there. I think that's a great hire. And on top of it, like, you talk to anyone in Denver, Wes Unseld Jr. is a fucking hell of a coach. Like, does an incredible job with their defense. I mean, think about how hard it is to craft a functioning defense around Nikola Jokic. And it works, right? I mentioned him probably a week ago on Twitter as someone that I thought made a lot of sense for these teams that have an open vacancy to chase. So I would fully endorse Wes Unseld Jr. as a head coach. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, right? Like, you never know what happens when an assistant moves up. But, like, for instance, Nate Bjorkgren, right, went full disaster mode. But Unseld doesn't have that, reputation or anything like that. So you would hope it would work.
And while Scott Brooks is, you know, there have been discussions about him being elsewhere, you know, for a little while now, whether his fit with the Wizards, I advocated for him not to be brought back. He was the seventh longest tenured head coach in the NBA. And now, other than the top six of Pop, Spo, Carlisle, Kerr, Snyder, and Malone, every other coach in the NBA was hired by their current team 2018 or later.
That's hilarious. That's wild.
But you were going to say something else when I interrupted you.
Well, here's what I was going to say about Scott Brooks. And I think that, yeah, in terms of like on-court product, there is no defining mechanism with which you can like expect him to be successful, right? What he does have a great reputation for, at the very least, is developing players, which makes me like think of Orlando, for instance, right? You know, Steve Clifford leaves. Steve Clifford, floor raiser, not necessarily, you know, doesn't love playing rookies if he doesn't have to. Not a great fit for that Orlando job. I wonder if Scott Brooks is a fit for that Orlando job, just in terms of development and everything.
And it's always, you know, in those circumstances, and we brought this up with Wes Unseld. Oh, nope, Scott Brooks didn't play for the Magic. I thought he did. I was thinking of Scott Skiles. My bad. So that also means that there are six open head coaching positions in the NBA. New Orleans and Washington open today. And then Orlando, Portland, Boston, and Indiana. And that is a stronger than usual group. I mean, in terms of teams that you could, there are three teams there, Boston, Indiana, and Portland, that I would expect, knowing what we know right now, to make the playoffs next year. Maybe not a ton of noise, except in the case of Boston. And then New Orleans, Washington, absolutely plausible. And then Orlando is more the rebuilding job, but I think it's a reasonably palatable rebuilding job. You know, it's not like, it's going to take a while, but they have their own picks. They, you know, don't have a ton of terrible money on the books beyond this coming season. So, like, that's a pretty strong set of openings, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I'm trying to think if there's going to be anything else that opens. Probably not, is kind of my immediate reaction to that. Unless, like, Milwaukee just, like, totally flames out in their next game, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah. Milwaukee, it seems like, has a pretty good chance to open, I guess. And that would immediately be like the highest tier job on the market. But I think that, you know, Washington's such an interesting job because they have the impending Bradley Beal decision to make. Like, you basically have to try to extend him or you have to try to trade him. Like, there's not really an in-between. Like, if he says no to the extension, you have to move him this summer, right?
Because that's an indication, like, as much as he said he wants to stay, that's an indication that he's not committed to it. You know, like that, it's different than last offseason where there was kind of a holding pattern for everyone because, you know, and get into that. So, yeah, I think that's a very fair point.
Okay.
The next, The next thing that happened, this is less surprising. It was, I think, roughly an hour after that, that Mike Conley is going to miss Game 5.
Okay.
And we got a little bit of subsequent stuff from Conley himself, actually. I saw Tim McMahon with it first. So here, I'll read you the quote. Conley, I'd been pushing really hard to play early in the series and had a small setback related to the hammy during that process. This is why it's been extended a bit longer than I know we all like. Obviously, if I could play, I would.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure just went way off of him in terms of getting back with the Kawhi injury, right?
So yeah, that's true.
Like,
And theoretically, worst comes to worst, if they lose Game 5 on Wednesday U.S. time,
yeah,
they could try to rush him back for game, or not, maybe it's not even rushing, but to have him back for Game 6.
Right.
And Donovan Mitchell, like, we wondered about what his status, and while I'm worried about a re-injury there, just because we've seen him tweak that right ankle a couple of times,
right,
the Jazz are in a pretty good spot, and right, they don't need to be aggressive right now. And the other thing is, like, for Utah, if they need to be aggressive with Conley, they'll know ahead of time. It's not going to be a circumstance where things, and even if they lose one game, then they'll get into that. We also, kind of, this again is not a surprise, Kyrie Irving is going to miss Game 6 of that series, and Harden is actually not listed on the injury report. That doesn't mean he's healthy, but he's not listed on the injury report after that bananas Game 5. So not really a lot to talk about there. That is exactly what we expected.
Yeah, we're gonna close the show talking about Kevin Durant for sure.
Oh, but, absolutely.
Not a surprise there with Kyrie. I figured at this point he wouldn't be back before 7. We'll see if Kevin Durant can just, like, flat out rip Milwaukee's heart out in Game 6.
And then at about 11 o'clock Pacific time, we got the news that Donnie Nelson is no longer going to be a part of the Dallas Mavericks franchise. Nelson has been involved there since, I believe, 98, because he moved over from the Suns. And
I mean, that's hilarious in light of the story that The Athletic published earlier this week.
Since I know you swear on your podcast, the, as Mark Cuban put it, total bullshit report that was out there at The Athletic earlier this week. And subsequent reporting, I believe, was from McMahon, that the decision was made on Sunday. And as is a natural follow-up question, there have been conflicting tea leaf readings on whether, and this originally was stunning, the first person to say anything on this was Kevin O'Connor, who said that he said it looks like Bob Lagares is going to be gone too, but then that has been walked back a bit, and it's unclear.
Can we talk real quick though about the story that Tim and Sam published, which is amazing?
Oh, absolutely.
On a number of fronts, first and foremost, like, shout out to Tim and Sam. And I've, you know, DM'd with Bob a couple times, and he's been nothing but good to me. You know, has been complimentary of me, and I'm very appreciative of that from Bob. And this was before he was working for the Mavericks and everything.
And in the interest of disclosure, I have had interactions with Bob as well.
Yeah, and, you know, has been nothing but good to me. So, like, that shades this a little bit. But that story to me, I thought Robbie Calland put it best from Up Rocks. He was like, man, how much does Bob Vulgaris have to be hated in that Mavericks office for that story to come out? Because it just felt like one after another person went to Tim and Sam and was like, oh, we shitting on Bob? Oh, I'll give you everything. You know what I mean?
And there was dirt that presumably came from different places, like the stuff with the scouting and the 2020 draft. And then
I will say this too. Like, I talked to, I don't know what happened there, but I do know that there were a couple agencies that weren't super happy with the Mavs draft process on their end. We'll put it that way.
Mm. And that's another interesting constituency to consider in some of this type of stuff. And as the piece got into, and I thought to me, this was the money quote was from an unnamed team source, which is always fun. Basically that Cuban is the most important person in the Mavericks organization, and number two is whoever he listens to.
Right.
And that means you get all of this complicated stuff in terms of soft power and hard power, in terms of, like, okay, yep, if Cuban is the decider, who actually has his ear? And it gets into the point where titles don't matter anymore. And I mean titles referring to job titles, not championships.
Yeah.
And it is extremely difficult to calibrate in those circumstances. And that could even lead to a circumstance where, like, maybe Bob Vigaris isn't on the payroll anymore, but he still has power within the organization. It could lead to the reverse.
It's like what happens in Sacramento, right? It's whoever has Vivexier.
Right.
Whenever you talk to people in Sacramento, right? Like Joe Dumars had Vivexier while he wasn't working for the organization, seemingly. So, yeah, I mean, that's what happens with these ownership situations that are very involved. And look, I don't mean to compare Mark Cuban to Vivek. I think that would be wholly unfair to Cuban. He's just not a meddler like that. He is involved, from what I gather, but not nearly as impulsive and impatient with these things, right? So it's interesting, though, that in light of that story, like, and you wonder, I mean, yeah, I have a lot of, I don't want to like get into like the background of that with like one of our stories at the site. I'm just fascinated by how that came together. It was literally just like, hey everybody, let's go shit on Bob Vulgaris hour. I mean,
it was,
that's what it and felt like.
Tim McMahon also reported that they've hired Sportsology, which is a consulting firm that has often been used in GM searches to look for a new head of basketball operations.
Is that Mike Forte, right?
It is.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, there is a lot that we will learn about the Mavericks. I mean, they haven't changed personnel leaders in a long time. And so we'll learn a lot about Mark Cuban and his process by what we can tell about the power structure whenever they hire and announce the next steps.
Yep. Okay. That's a lot.
That's pretty much everything. I think so. The other thing that came out during that time, because I know you'll have thoughts on it, was that LaMelo Ball was announced as Rookie of the Year.
Oh, okay. Expected. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anthony Edwards had a great second half of the year, but was not awesome in the first half.
Right. That's actually something you and I talked about the last time we did a podcast together.
Yeah.
So, if memory serves.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the totality of a season, I thought LaMelo was better. Anthony Edwards' second half was better than, arguably anything LaMelo did. But I don't think that it made up for the difficulties that Edwards had early in the season, where he was like a genuine negative player for Minnesota. Good for LaMelo. I think that's who I would have voted for, as I said on the podcast with Tony Jones doing awards. So yeah, good for LaMelo.
And I'm looking briefly through to see if there's, and so
yeah, what is the Calipari thing now?
So as I heard, I looked it up a little bit after you mentioned it. And I think it's that there was a report from Yahoo about kind of coaching candidates to watch. It was Ben Rohrbach and Vince Goodwill. And I believe that Calipari was included in that. So they had sources that told them he would be open to jumping back to the NBA. And Calipari has since denied it. But I don't know. It seems possible.
Yeah, I mean, any time that John Calipari's name comes up with NBA jobs, I'm always pretty skeptical because it hasn't happened yet, right? I will say that, like, it hasn't even been a secret. Like, I think it's been pretty open that Calipari was not super pleased with the way that this season went. But I would be staggered if he would go. I mean, just like think about it logically. Like, John Calipari makes like $10 million a year and basically has a lifetime contract at Kentucky. Like, I understand that maybe he wants a different challenge, but I can't envision giving that up in order to go shoot your shot in the NBA again, right?
That seems reasonable to me. I mean, maybe he's at the point, you start to think about your like basketball mortality, and he's just like doesn't want his NBA resume to be closed where it is. It's possible, but I don't know.
Maybe. I mean,
but so
I get it.
I mean,
yeah.
The other thing for me, and this can be a way to tie it back to where you wanted to end it, is all of this happening on the heels of that incredible, indelible Game 5 performance by Kevin Durant and the win by the Nets and everything else. It's like, it's also unfortunate, and it's a part of why when I did Real GM Radio with Ben Taylor, we spent the first 40 minutes talking about that game. Because we had a lot of thoughts and we had everything we want to talk about. It's because I, First of all, I love the game on the court. Like, that is, even though I do, you and I both do a lot of stuff in terms of the, you know, yeah, the CBA and everything else. It's like, we love watching basketball. That's why we spend the time to know it the way we do. And that was an incredible one.
It was unbelievable. It was, we literally got to see, you know, in my case yesterday afternoon, in your case last night, one of, you know, someone who's going to go down at the very least as one of the 20 best players in NBA history, let's say. He painted his masterpiece last night.
Like at 32.
At 32 years old, coming off of a torn Achilles 2 years ago, he painted his masterpiece. It was unbelievable. It was one of the best performances I've ever seen on a basketball court. To play all 48 minutes like that in a moment where your team desperately needs you to be as efficient as he was as a scorer, nobody could stay in front of him. Like, absolutely zero human beings on planet Earth could stay in front of him last night. He's so shifty. His shot making is so unbelievable. I mean, that shot where he got the ball with like 3 seconds left on the shot clock and had to put together like two quick counters into a wrong-footed pull-up three.
Over a defender who was right there.
Yeah.
Chris Middleton, like, was there.
Those are things that, like, nobody else on planet Earth basically can do, because nobody else is 7 foot tall with that high of a release point and that shifty. I mean, Kevin Durant is... Look, this has been a very pro-Kevin Durant podcast for a long time, and it will continue to be that. I'm just glad that, like, people have... It seems like last night, for whatever reason, I'm not saying this is right, I think it's really fucking stupid that people didn't give Kevin Durant his due before, but it seems like last night could act as a bit of a turning point for people getting back on the Kevin Durant side of things.
And he's an unbelievable player. Durant had to do some creation last night, which has not been his forte. He's inconsistent as a passer, but the Bucks couldn't stop him, so that was sometimes creating looks for others. The way that Steve Nash and the coaching staff eventually like had him screening for Joe Harris, there was a play that Harden threw a wonderful pass that that generated Harris's only made two-pointer of the game. And for me, what's so memorable about that Durant performance is the degree of difficulty physically, mentally, and skill-wise. So playing all 48 minutes, most of the time, he was their best defensive player on the floor. Not that their defense was great, but he was their best defensive player on the floor. He was the only offensive player who could simultaneously pass and move. So that is something that he can, that Kevin Durant can do that James Harden at his present state cannot. And they needed every iota of that Durant performance in order to do it. He had 17 rebounds, was disruptive on the defensive end, not possession by possession, but had his real spots. So it's going to be, it is an indelible performance. It is the, as you said, it's his masterpiece. And yes, this is not Kevin Durant's technically his highest scoring playoff game ever. He had 50 against the Clippers in a game in 2019. But this was incredible. And he had to do everything. He did do everything. And now the Nets are still alive, because that's the other part of this. I talked about the degree of difficulty. Were the stakes.
Yep. The stakes were incredibly high in that game. Like, it's hard to overstate how unbelievably high it is when it's Milwaukee up 17 in the third quarter. They were up 17 midway through the third quarter. That's the other thing. Like, oh my God. It was just like watching a slow car crash on the part of Milwaukee too. Like, I don't understand what Mike Budenholzer is doing in this series. He's not this dumb. Like, Mike Budenholzer has been an incredibly successful NBA coach, and he's never really adjusted, but at the same token, like, you can't have the success that he has had over the course of his career with, like, in Atlanta, for instance, a good roster, but not an overwhelmingly talented roster, right? You can't have had the success that he's had over the course of his career and still not be able to just be totally inert in the playoffs, right? Like, the fact that they're still setting ball screens 23 feet from the rim, 22 feet from the rim, is bonkers to me. Like, well, set a ball screen 30 feet from the rim, for God's sake. Make them cover more area in space. Like, defensively, do something a little bit different. Like, throw Giannis on Kevin Durant for three possessions. I'm not saying you put him on him the whole time, right? Giannis's best skill defensively is being really, really good in help. But you know what? It might help just to get Kevin Durant thinking about things a little bit differently if you put the guy that's 6'11 with a 7'6 wingspan on him, who can actually move his feet a little bit, right? And look, maybe it wouldn't work. Kevin Durant was in such a zone last night that it was just, it was one of the best performances in NBA history. But maybe he goes for 43, 17, and 10 if you make him think about things a little bit differently. It's just, it's tricky. You know what I, like, I understand that, I understand that NBA coaching is hard on the fly, but like, he's just done nothing now for two straight years. And it's hard to really like make excuses for that at this point.
And the one to me that was so much more galling in game five than other points in this series is that Brooklyn played James Harden 45 and a half minutes. He could not move defensively and really much offensively. And on both ends of the floor, the Bucks did not sufficiently attack that. Like, you are given a huge competitive advantage. And Harden, I mean, I thought that he was a net negative in the first half and more of a net positive in the second half, but a lot of that was just the Bucks not challenging him enough. And so whether that's put the ball in the hands of somebody like Drew Holiday and say, Drew, make a couple of moves, make him push off, react, second efforts, everything else like that. And they failed at that. And then there were other moments where they didn't realize Harden was shooting every three-pointer short and he wasn't driving at all. And so, you can actually do something with that. You don't have to take Brook Lopez off the floor because Kevin Durant is massacring him. You could just put Brook Lopez on Harden and say, okay, James, you want to shoot some threes? You're 0 for 8. Take a couple more.
Yep. Yeah, totally that. And look, part of that isn't even on Mike Budenholzer either. Like,
sure. He's still the head of the ship. And if the player, totally. Like, if the players aren't doing it and you want them to do it, you light into them to do it.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that. But like on some level too, Giannis, for instance, on that like fadeaway heard around the world where James Harden was like, no, back off, I got this on Giannis. Like, he knows that Giannis is going to fade away, or he's going to be able to just, or he's going to attack and he's going to be able to hack the shit out of him. Right. So that's on Giannis. Giannis needs to pull that ball out and try to get ahead of steam, I think, and force the defense to collapse and maybe make a pass because he's such an adept passer for someone who's 6'11, or just try to be hardened to the spot so that when he tries to foul you, inevitably, he really actually is fouling you before he can stop you from going to the rim and getting a clean look at the rim and scoring, right? So part of this is on Giannis. Like, he had 34 and 12 and or 32 and 14 or whatever the hell he had last night, but it's... I think that like Drew and Middleton last night were a bigger problem than Giannis, but at the same token, like Giannis is the head of the snake here, and he did not perform well enough last night. And this is a team that has genuine NBA title aspirations, and you only go as far as your best player can take you in the biggest moments. And Giannis has, over the course of the last 3 years now, unfortunately not been able to take them to where they need to go in the late fourth quarter moments that are most important in tight games.
And it's also a challenge that the Bucks are dealing with a best player who is not a great free throw shooter and who doesn't particularly appear to want to take those free throws in crunch time. And that, you know, I don't know why he mishandled the ball with like 16 seconds to go when they had a chance to take the lead. I don't know if that was spooked on free throws or if that was just him thinking a step ahead or something else.
I mean, that shit happens, right?
Like, it does. It does. It could just be random chance. It probably was. But all of those things do fit together, and it's a challenge that Milwaukee's going to have to rectify. And then the other part of it is, yes, Giannis guarding Kevin Durant's an interesting idea, but Giannis is a talented defender who cannot get through a screen. Like that is, and he is physically capable at some point in his career of doing it if he wants to put in the time and everything, because... Well, he is a big dude. He also moves very well. And so what part of what Kevin Durant has done, like he's driven by him in isolation too. But one of the huge wrinkles that the Nets brought in towards the second half of game five, which opened things up and allowed Durant after actually a fairly rough by his standards first half, was they started setting the screens for Durant when he had the ball in his hands. And so then that way PJ Tucker has to recover. And that is something very different. He can't be as handsy, everything else. And so like, that is something that is not going away. And if they, if you replace PJ Tucker with Giannis, you don't solve the question. Now, maybe if you try to have PJ Tucker and Giannis as the two players guarding the screener, but Brooklyn, none of their screeners are particularly amazing. They'll just set the screen with someone else.
Yeah, I think Milwaukee genuinely should win this series just based off of talent and based off.
I still think they will.
Potential adjustments are, but.
I mean, Kevin Durant and Jeff Green going 7-for-8. Now, you can argue Jeff Green going 7-for-8 from three, that could be offset by Joe Harris hitting some of the good looks that he missed, though I think the Bucks deserve some credit for making those looks, some of them, harder. Maybe Harden can jump shoot a little bit better in a subsequent game, but also, the effort that it took, maybe Kevin Durant is capable of this. Maybe missing part of the season and he has the juice to play another two 48-minute games. But, I mean, Brooklyn needed a lot to go right to win this game at home. And so I think the Bucks win game six. And then after that, who the hell knows?
I would say that the Bucks win game six if Mike Budenholzer is willing to make the adjustments necessary that actually make sense within the context of winning a 7-game playoff series against one of the best players on planet Earth. Actually, frankly, the best player on planet Earth in Kevin Durant. Beyond that, it's hard for me to have confidence right now.
There's no reason to have confidence.
Well, the reason to have confidence is that Milwaukee, when Kyrie and James Harden are hurt like this, Milwaukee is a better team than them. Like, Milwaukee is a more talented group than the freaking Brooklyn Nets without Kyrie and James Harden. And look, this is making excuses beyond what we should make excuses for Milwaukee for. I do think the Dante DiVincenzo thing really hurt them, because that was 35 minutes a night of a guy that can play on both ends of the court that is not a mismatch for any of those guys out there, right? He's not a guy that makes you play 4-on-5 on one end of the court. Like, Pat Connaughton, I'm sorry, but like, Pat Connaughton was getting roasted last night.
Yes, like, he was.
It's a big loss to lose 35 minutes a night or 30 minutes a night of a two-way player that can bring you actual, like, maybe not necessarily value, but isn't a negative when he's out there in the biggest moments like Dante can.
Yeah, fair point.
So, all right, Danny, this has been fun. My brain is sufficiently broken. I am glad that we were able to do this. I'm glad you convinced me to do this, because that was fun. By the way, I'm going to see Fast 9 tonight. So that's what I was looking for when I woke. I was looking forward to that when I woke up this morning. And you gave me something to pass the time until Fast 9 at 6:30 p.m. tonight. Or is it F9? I'm sorry. Fast and Whatever. Furious 9. Whatever it's called.
The naming conventions in that series are almost as convoluted as the continuity.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We know Han's back. That's all we care about. We've seen it in the trailers. That's the most important thing. Danny, tell the people where they can find your work.
You can check out podcasting. It's pretty much Dunked On Prime. Nate and I are doing both things now. We also do the live show, NBA Cast, which is through Hot Mic right now, which is pretty fun. It syncs up with your audio. The really cool piece of technology. And then at some point, you'll probably see some work by the two of us together at The Athletic. I'm recovering from a broken collarbone, so I'm not writing as much right now, but I will be back soon.
How in the hell did you break your collarbone?
I fell on a bicycle, the way most people break their collarbone.
So, like, this is like the pilot of The West Wing?
I mean, sure.
Oh, man. Well, Danny,
but I'm a month out, so we're getting there.
Get better soon, Danny. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. We'll be back later this week. I've got a podcast scheduled to record with Matt Penny tomorrow. It'll probably go up at this point on Saturday U.S. time, maybe Friday U.S. time. But until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.